Good evening, and welcome to this evening's program talk of the Staples Inn Actuarial Society. My name is Raluca Ștefan, and I'm the SIAS chair for the evening. Before I introduce tonight's talk, I have a couple of notices about upcoming SIAS events. Our next social event is on 29th of January. We are holding our annual SIAS pub quiz at Steam Wine Bar. We are looking forward to seeing you there and challenge your brains after the holiday season. Our next program event will be on Wednesday, 5th of February. The talk promises to help life practitioners tackle the practical challenges of the IFRS 17 risk adjustment implementation. Further details and online registration for this event are available on our website. Also, the program team is currently finalizing the talks for this year, so please keep your eyes on our website for any new talks that will be presented. Next, a few standard notices about tonight's event. So tonight's event is hosted by SIAS. We do encourage those of you that aren't currently SIAS members to join SIAS. Membership is extremely good value, £23 for the IFRS fellows and £12 for the IFRS student. Further details are provided on our website. There is an attendance sheet in the smaller room just outside the hall. If you didn't sign in on the way in, don't forget to sign it on your way out. Attendance at these talks does not get added automatically to your CPD records, so please remember to update your CPD in the normal way after tonight. We are eager for our talks to run as smoothly and effectively as possible, and we'll be delighted to hear any feedback you have. We will email you a short online survey after the talk, so please take a minute or two to complete this. We need your feedback to create the best possible experience for our members. If the fire alarm sounds during the meeting, please exit using the fire exits in the back hall. And finally, a reminder to switch off your mobile phones. Tonight's talk will last around 1 hour and will be followed by a Q&A with the speaker. If you have a question, please raise your hand and a microphone will be brought to you. We value everyone's contribution at our talks, so there's a bottle of champagne on offer for the best contribution to the discussion by a student, a member of the Institute, and another for the best contribution from a fellow. So please clearly state your name and whether you're a student or a fellow before you ask your question. Following the meeting, there will be sandwiches and a networking drinks in the smaller room just outside the hall. So please do join us there. So back to tonight's talk. Just a minute before starting my speech, I was told that Patrick is quite well known to SIAS, so he's presented here before. So we are delighted to have him again tonight. Patrick is an actuary who has made a transition to working in software architectural and artificial intelligence. He holds Microsoft professional qualifications in data science, big data, and artificial intelligence, and is currently working towards the DevOps qualification. He is a member of the IFRS Council and is also president of the Wessex Actuarial Society. He is also a member of the Institute and the RSS Joint Data Science Focus Group. During his talk tonight, Patrick will talk about his experiences of taking multiple online courses on data science and will try to explain the differences between data science, big data, and AI. So, over to you, Patrick.
Thank you. You might not realise the last time I gave a talk at Staple Inn was 1991 on a paper called How Risky Are Equities Over the Long Term. So this is quite a different subject, but I'm delighted to be back and to have a full room. Thank you very much for inviting me. This topic is very dear to my heart. I'm passionate about IT and about the power of processing and data and getting the most of it, and really excited by what AI can do. Now, definitions vary, but I'll give you my personal take on what I think the differences between the three areas are. I've got a lot of slides. I will rush through some of them, but they're going to be available afterwards, and they've got quite a bit of detail on as a reference. I like my slides to have enough information so you can understand them, even if you weren't necessarily at the talk. So please forgive me if I do rush through some of them. So what are we going to talk about tonight? Well, my goals today, you're obviously a warm audience towards this topic, otherwise you wouldn't have come. So what I would like to do is to give you something, I hope perhaps more than one thing, but something that you can take away that will advance your interest in this subject or your career, and point you towards some useful tools that I found useful, and hope again that at least one of those you will think, oh, yes, I could use that. And give you pointers so that when you're exploring things, you can say, yes, this might be a place to go to, and I can then explore my journey further. And I will also try and raise some questions that I hope will spark your interest and share my view as to why I think it's such an exciting area to be in. So I'll give it a bit of background about myself. I will also talk a bit about these MOOCs, these massive open online courses. I've taken, I think, 33 so far, not all related to data science and AI big data, but all in this sort of area. And I will give, as I said, an introduction to each of the three areas as I've understood them from doing these Microsoft courses, and try and cover the differences between them as I see those differences, because definitions vary and people, it's so vague often, you don't know what you're talking about. And what I would like to cover is the toolkits that I've found useful. I've listed some of them there are more in the slides, and issue some challenges for you to think about and some questions to spark debate. I hope you'll have other questions as well that you will raise and get those lovely bottles of champagne. So my background on this, I'm an actuary, but I've always been interested in IT and programming. And I started off my career as a pensions and investment actuary at what is now Willis Towers Watson, but was at the time R. Watson & Sons, and then became Watson Wyatt. I then left to set up a company called Inca Limited with David Wilkie and Alan Marriott, and that was doing pensions valuation software, stochastic asset liability modeling, and we also did a pensions valuation system. We did data manipulation, and about 2009, 2010, realized that the cloud was the place to be, so made the transition to that, which took quite a bit of time, and got increasingly interested in the power of parallel processing and big databases. And then being on IFA Council two or three years ago, I started to think, well, we are, as actuaries, in danger of being overtaken by data scientists, even if they don't necessarily have the background in rigor and problem solving that we have. Their tools that they have are getting incredibly powerful, and they've got a very good marketing engine behind them with the giants, tech giants like Microsoft and Google and Amazon pushing them, because if those people use the platforms, then those big tech giants will make a lot of money, because you know every software developer, every data scientist who's grown up using the Google platform, they get fees for that. So there's a lot of marketing in there, and as actuaries, we need to compete. But also, I think we have a lot to offer, and it's exciting stuff for us, because we are interested in data, and we think we can offer insights that, with our financial knowledge and our business knowledge, we can others perhaps can't do. But we can't rest on our laurels. We have to compete, and so we have to study. So I made the decision to get into this area. I've worked for a couple of tech companies. The Zupertech is a software development house trying to do exciting new stuff. But I'm currently working at a company called CADS, which is Computer and Design Services, which is actually slightly wider field. It's an engineering company, and they do stuff like designing reinforced concrete. They do inspections of scaffolds, and by law, a scaffold has to be inspected at least every once a week, and the reports have to be sent. So they have lots of mobile apps and lots of distributed stuff happening, and I've been recruited to design new apps for them, but also to start bringing in DevOps, which is the automation of software testing, and AI as well to help them extract value from the data. I've only been there a few months, and I haven't quite got to the AI stage, but I've done a lot of DevOps and a lot of data processing and automation of querying and things like that. So, MOOCs. Why do it? Well, for me, it's massively convenient. You could do it in your spare time, which is what I did. It's not quite as much as doing the actuarial exams. I worked out as an average of 5 hours a week I spent over 2.5 years to do these three programs, professional programs. The professional programs were offered by Microsoft. Unfortunately, they stopped doing them in about October last year for some inexplicable reason, with no real explanation. But they were good because it was a good badge of, if you did that, at least you knew what they were saying was the things you should be studying. And you get a certificate from it. It's 10 courses. There's a bit of overlap between the three programs. So I think I did 27 in all to get the three programs. But each one is 10 courses. The first nine give you the basics, and the 10th is a bit of a capstone project, which is supposed to test everything that you've done and be approximating to a real-world problem. So I'll go through that. It's relatively cheap, so it's convenient. You can do it in your own time. You've got video training. You can do it on the train with headphones. It's very cheap, $99 per course. So, you know, for $1,000, you can get one of these programs. Well, we could. There are equivalents, but they're different, slightly different. There's a wide range of courses, very wide range. There's lots of different providers. So if you are interested in this subject, you will be able to find something that you'll enjoy. You might have to try a few courses because things are not always what you think they are when you start off with them. You get certification, so you can get an online certificate you can put on your LinkedIn profile. So it's good validation, and compared to doing the actuarial exams, it's very quick to do because the courses typically took between 12 and 40 hours. So within a few weeks, you can get a certificate and you can get a high mark as well. Unlike the actuarial exams, which is much more subjective, you can get, I think I averaged 96% over the 27 courses. And I was disappointed when I didn't get 100%. So, but there you are. And the downside to that is that you're very largely on your own. They encourage people. This is edX, the provider I use. They encourage you to work with others, not to cheat by sharing, but to collaborate as you would with fellow students and ask questions while you're exploring, but not do the final test together. Now, in practice, I didn't do that. I found that they have discussion forums for this, but they're not very high quality. So I was not that impressed with that. In any case, you can do it on your own. If you're an actuary and you're logical or you're a mathematician or you've got other, you know, economics knowledge, you've got other suitable skills, then I think you can probably do a lot of it on your own. But that is a downside if you want to socialize with it. So, data science, that was the first one I did. And my take on that is that this is mainly about manipulating data. It's not so much the very, very advanced stuff. It's cleaning the data and analyzing it, manipulating it, getting data from different sources together, all the sort of dirty work that you have to do at the start, but can be fun once you start getting insights. It's statistics as well. So all the standard stuff about standard deviations, looking at the distribution and trying to see what's interesting about the data, what's unusual about it, that to me is part of data science. Presentation of results, that's very important because unless you can present it to senior management or your clients in the way that they will understand, then your insights are not going to get acted on. So that to me is part of data science, is the be able to persuade people that what you've found is important, is significant, and matters from a business point of view. And management insights as well. So the 10 courses that I had on the professional program for data science, first of all, just an orientation. Then it was, and I'll cover a bit more detail on these for some of them, Transact SQL, which is the query language for databases, and analyzing, visualizing data. Again, the communications part of that. I use Power BI. There's another very good piece of software called Tableau, but that I didn't use. I have to say, with a caveat, all the stuff I've done, with a few exceptions, Google, has been heavily Microsoft-based because once you start on the program, you want to do those courses. And statistics for data analysis. Now, obviously, that was I knew a lot of that, but it's quite interesting to see how much you can do with Excel. There was a lot on Excel. R, of course, R and Python are heavily used at the moment for data science. So, of course, in that. Data science essentials, that was an overview. Principles of machine learning. And then R, again, for data science, that was a slightly more advanced course rather than just basic R. The first one was mainly just teaching you about the types of different objects you have in R. This was specifically for data science. And then big data with R, that was Microsoft's server version of it, where you can do parallel processing, because otherwise the normal R just runs in your computer memory and you can't deal with very large data sets. And you can even find, even without very large data sets, it's very slow. So this is the more powerful end. And, of course, Microsoft's point of view, they get paid for it. So they have an incentive to get you to use the R server. But that was interesting. Looking at New York taxi data, there's a big public data set on that, and looking at fares and how it varied by location and time of day and week. The final project, there was a capstone project, which is meant to, as I said, to encapsulate all or challenge you on all the work you've done, or most of it. That was building a predictive model to see how much damage would be done to particular buildings after an earthquake in Nepal, because they had very bad earthquakes about four or five years ago. And depending on the location and the construction and the height and the width of the building, you had some training data, and you had to then... You built a model, you were then tested to see how well your model fitted on another set of data. So that was part of it. You also had to analyze the data to start off with and point out what the salient aspects of it were and explain them to someone else in a report. You had to produce a report overall, explain your model. And an interesting feature of this is that it was peer marked. So you were marked by your fellow students. But they were, so that worked quite well. But I've got a blog, pjd.net, and if you want more details of that, then of the data science program, you can get information on that. I'm happy to answer questions after this event in more detail on any of this. So that was a bit more about the capstone project. So what you had is three levels of damage. One, two, and three. And most of this is the test data set that we were given to use. Most of the data points related to the medium damage. Is that? Yeah. So a lot of data for that. Most of the data was level two. Level three was the highest level of damage, and very few for level one. And this on the right is using Python to do histograms segmented by what level of damage it was. That is according to levels 1, 2, and 3 of damage, and the base, the x-axis there is the geographic location. So we had three levels of location. I think one would be area, then it gets, the second level would be sort of town, and then it would be postcode. So there's lots of different factors, but that's as an example of the sort of charts that Python can produce quite easily, segmented by particular value of a conditional on a value of a data point. So I was using Azure, like Microsoft Machine Learning Studio, the tool for that, and the model that I produced in the end was a multi-class logistic regression. It's a classifier, it's a classification. A typical thing is predicting whether someone's a good risk for a bank loan. Good or bad, just two categories. This is multi-class because we're trying to categorize, classify a building, depending on its location and characteristics, whether it's going to suffer levels one, two, or three of damage. So that's why it's multi-class. And what the Microsoft Visual, the Machine Learning Studio does, it has a very nice user interface that you can drag and drop to create your model, but it also has output. This is the confusion matrix to say how well the model actually worked at the end. Now, you had to get a pass mark of 60% to be able to predict 60% accuracy in order to pass this course. That is my first alarm. to tell me I've now spent 15 minutes, I will speed up. So you can't predict with perfect accuracy, especially as you haven't got a lot of data for there was only 33% accurate at predicting the level of damage one because we had so few data points for it. It was much better for the 1-2, the level 2, and not so bad for the level 3, but still only not much more than a third. So the model, it was not brilliant, but nevertheless, it was still enough to pass. And it shows that some of the model, you don't have to be perfect to get. They're still adding better than guessing. But that was an interesting exercise. Big data. Now, what I understand by that, I would say it's more computational techniques. It's more in the realm of computing rather than data science or artificial intelligence. It's dealing with lots of different types of data. So instead of having very, very structured data that would fit in a database and every single data point has the same columns, this would be where you have different types of data. So you might be combining social media data with blog data, with database table data, and combining it all together to build a more complete picture. That's part of it. Another aspect is where you have huge volumes of data. So, for example, if you've got telematics data from cars, well, that may be nicely structured, but you're getting huge volumes of it. Internet of Things data, all your devices, that if you've got smart devices like smart fridges, or if you have British Gas's Hive, then there's data being transmitted all the time on that, and this is huge volumes of data. And traditional databases don't cut the muscle for that. So it's techniques to deal with that. And it's essentially, to me, a computing problem. You have to start thinking about distributed processes, because you can't do it on a single machine, or you could, but it would just take so much memory and it would be too slow. So you have to split the data up. And that inevitably means probably a cloud, the most efficient way. You could do it on-premise, but you'd end up having lots of servers, and it's very expensive and risky. So the 10 courses, again, there was an orientation. I put the three courses that was overlap in green. So I'd already done those three. I got credit for them automatically. The analyzing and visualizing data, the T-SQL, transactional SQL course, and the big data with R. Introduction to NoSQL data solutions, that's what I mentioned, where the data is not structured so much. So you can have records have different fields. And an example might be in an online store, you'll have products, different categories of products, and each category would have different fields. So, measurements will be different for different types of clothes. A DVD would have different characteristics from, say, a pair of boots. So you want a way of being able to store all this diverse data efficiently in similar places, and that's what a lot of these NoSQL, not only structured query language databases are, and they're very powerful. The process big data at sorry implemented data warehouse, that is where you've got huge volumes of data, but it tends to be structured data, usually after the unstructured data has been processed and you've got the information you want, but you want to collate it and keep storing it so you can look at trends. So typically data will be processed and put into a data warehouse where it's then got the value that you need, but you need to compare that over time, and again you get huge volumes of it. So Microsoft's solution is to have this data warehouse, which is a very expensive version of their SQL Server, and they have lots and lots of 64 databases, and they're communicating together, and sometimes they're actually synchronizing data. So it's a big trade-off between having data that you can access quickly, but also not making it too expensive. It's a big problem. And I'm not sure I really like the data warehouse solution. I wasn't too keen on it when I looked into it. process big data at rest. That is data that is, it's not sort of happening minute by minute like share prices would be, but it could be a weekly stock take, or that was the example they gave us, an inventory that's taken by lots of different stores for a retail organisation once a week, and that's collated. So that is data that is not streaming. Whereas Internet of Things devices, like telematics, that is streaming. That's happening in real time, and share price happening in real time. So you need different techniques to cope with those. Now, when you've got big data, if you think back to the traditional problem of data processing, you've got your data, you could process it, you have the program goes through, it runs it, it gets the answers. Now, you can't do that with big data because the data is split out. So you've got lots of different programs running, and you need to combine the results at the end. So hence this word orchestrate. You need to have a way of telling when the different processes are finished and combining, collating the results. And inevitably, some of the individual programs will fail for some reason. Perhaps there's something wrong with the data. You need to be able to go back, identify those, fix them if you can, and then collate them. So there's an orchestrator. There's a role for a conductor. A Microsoft solution to that is as your data factory. And then the capstone project I'll come on to. So this was the capstone project. There were three separate challenges, and this was simulating a large retail store that had weekly stock takes from all its different... a large retail company that had different branches around the country, and each one would do an inventory and send that. You'd collect the data from that each week, and then you would process it and put it in the data warehouse at the end. So this was actually simulating the different aspects of that. So it's not particularly exciting from a sort of financial point of view, but it's a very important business structure. And that was not a peer-reviewed thing. That was just doing the exercise, and you had to put your results in for analysis, and if you've got the answer right, then you've got full marks for it. Otherwise, you've got zero. So, again, you can get 100% with this. So I think I did on that. And that's the orchestration. That's Azure Data Factory. So you have data... I mean, the data... This was done in 2019, but the data they had was from 2016. And you had in the left-hand window, you've got green is for data that has arrived and is ready to be processed and has been processed. The orange is where it's being processed. And then on the right, the red is where the data has not arrived or is in a bad state, so can't be run. So what happens is this, as your data factory is continuously checking to see whether the data is in a fit state. And if it's in a fit state, it then moves on to the next step. So it takes the work out of you having to do that. And I did, before I knew about this, I wrote a program that did some of this, and it was quite sobering to realize that I could have done it in this later on. But there's a problem with the software. There is so much stuff out there, and it's continually changing. So this is why I hope that by listing some of this here, you will have... You'll say, actually, there's something like that. I can. It may not be Microsoft you use, it may be Google or Amazon, but there will be something equivalent that you can use that will save you reinventing the wheel. So, AI. How am I doing for time? Good. So AI, to me, is the harder part. This is the bit where we're saying, instead of programming computers to think like us, to do things that we're good at but slow at, of course they're faster than us, but if we only program computers to do things the way we think, we're not going to make the best out of them. So this is actually going a stage beyond and saying, what are computers really good at? Let's get them to do things in ways that we wouldn't do, but which may actually turn out to be better, and actually seem to be turning out to be better than humans. So this is where it gets much harder for us to understand, precisely because computers are doing things in ways that they're discovering for themselves, or that have such huge numbers of parameters that it's very hard for us to understand. So the sort of algorithms that are involved here are these deep neural networks or deep learning networks, where you have lots and lots of layers of networks and different types of layers. And this is where there is a lot of maths involved if you really want to get into the depths of it. And I haven't been able to do that because the Microsoft course didn't really give you the maths, because it's aimed at people who wanted to get involved, started in AI rather than mathematicians. But as a mathematician, I would like to get more involved in it. But I did find it very hard going to understand how these things worked. I know they work, and I was able to run them, but as when time allows, I really want to get to grips with the maths behind this. And also, the first challenge for you is how do we tell whether a model is statistically significant when it's got lots of parameters? It can be hundreds of millions of parameters, but they still work, and it's surprising. And they don't often overfit. So the big data is necessarily involved in this, with one caveat I'll come to, because they've got such huge volumes of parameters, numbers of parameters, they will need lots of data. Otherwise, they're just going to overfit. So the course, introduction to it, Python. There were courses on Python I could have done in the data science or big data, but I chose to focus on R first because I thought, well, let's get to know R. And this time I chose Python because it was interesting to see. And actually, I think Python is preferred over R in data science at the moment. And I certainly found in the course that there were occasions when the R programs would run out of memory, but the Python one wouldn't. And these are the free ones. So I don't know about expensive paid ones. I suspect the Microsoft R server one would have been okay, because that would they'd be charging money for. Essential mathematics for machine learning. Well, this is a bit of optimization. So, you know, that was fairly... It didn't take me long to do that course. Ethics in law and data and analytics. This was pretty much American focused, US-based, because Microsoft being US company, so they talked about their laws on data protection. They did talk about GDPR a bit, but it's that sort of area, and I'll talk about that later. Data science essentials, well, because I've already done the data science course and principles of machine learning, again, didn't have to do that. Build deep learning models, that was an introduction to these very, very difficult but very powerful models that seem to be making inroads all over the place. And build reinforcement learning models. That was the course actually I enjoyed most, because it was something I could really understand. This was optimization. It was similar to courses I'd done at university in maths on dynamic stochastic programming. It had the Bellman equation, where you've got a multi-step problem, and you work back one step from the end. If you can find the solution there, then you can then go back two steps and say, well, given where I'm going to be in one step, if I know the solution, what do I do? And you just work backwards. And these were variants of that. There were some interesting aspects. So there were things like trying to get an object to move, or a mass, a hypothetical person, to move from A to B without falling off a cliff or with obstacles in the way. And you try randomly and eventually you'd find a solution, but you wanted to do it efficiently. And there was an interesting variant which is called epsilon greedy, where you find a solution that works. Fine. Okay, well, if you carry on doing that, it might be suboptimal. So what happens, there's with a probability of epsilon, which might be 10%, you vary it from time to time in the hope that you find a better solution. So that was quite a nice technique. And it was very mathematical, so I really enjoyed that. Build computer vision and image analysis. This is to do with things like recognizing objects, recognizing persons, recognizing fruit. But if you take the autonomous vehicle, it's obviously got to be able to tell the difference between a pedestrian and a vehicle, and they've got to do it at speed. And this is where these deep learning networks come in again. There were variants I could have done. I could have done speech recognition, and I've done some work on that anyway, and language understanding intelligence, where you speak like a chatbot. You don't um, You don't have to speak according, to type according to a script. You can say something else and it recognises it. There were variations on that, but I chose the computer vision one. And then the Capstone project. That was ostensibly about speech, classifying speech. You got samples of data saying, which accent is this? Is this a Canadian, an Indian, or an English accent? So it's a classification problem again. This time not earthquake damage, but just to classify sound into the native speaker's accent. Now, at first I thought it was sound, but actually what they'd given us is rather than the sound files, which should have been quite easy to listen to and cheat, they'd given us the spectrograms of the frequencies. So it's actually an image classification problem. And I can't tell visually, looking at those very easily, how to classify. That's the next one, 36. So the Canada's the top line, then India, and then England, the bottom line. I find it very hard to see patterns in that. So this is essentially an image classification. So the deep learning courses that I'd done came into use. And I did find this very hard. I eventually got it, but I would have to say that it was more trial and error than knowledge. And so I want to deepen my knowledge on this, but I find it very hard from a mathematical point of view and statistical point of view to understand why these things work. Because actually, again, the model had lots of parameters, and we only had some like 5,000 data points. So it was surprising that it worked. So my eventual solution was a CNN model, convolutional neural network model. It wasn't that exact one on the left. I'm not supposed to share the results I got from it, or even though I suppose the programs now, the professional programs stopped. But you have these lots of different layers. Some of them have small matrices that go around the image, and they're trying to detect things like edges and corners, concave patterns. And in theory, you can actually change these models so that they'll detect symmetry as well. So that if it's recognizing a banana and the banana's vertically orientated, and then you change the orientation slightly, it should still be able to recognize it. But that's not the standard CNN model. And they have, as you multiply the layers up, you get more and more parameters. So I find that very, very hard to understand, and without spending time on it, but you know, it does work, and a lot of data scientists just use these models because others have developed them and they seem to fit. Now, I didn't use Microsoft for that. I tried the Microsoft platform. There's the Machine Learning Studio, and also these they have Azure Notebooks where you can use free Python and R. I couldn't get this to work. Eventually, I tried a model using Google with its Keras software, which uses TensorFlow, and that worked. That got me a sufficiently high mark. I got, again, 60%. You have to be able to predict with 60% accuracy to pass. I got 65%, which is similar to what I got in the data science Capstone course. That translated to a mark of sort of 83%. So I was disappointed I couldn't get anywhere near my high 90s, but this is because it's much more difficult. So, toolkits that I found useful, and I hope you will find some of these, or at least remember them so that you can come back and look at it. So, humble Microsoft Excel, don't neglect that. There's a lot you can do, but also I'll show you where these other things come in. Structured query language, that's for heavier duty data queries. Microsoft Power BI, BI stands for business intelligence. That's where you have these interactive dashboards that can help you persuade your customers or your senior management that this is worth looking into, this course of action is better than that other course of action. Azure or Jupyter Notebooks, those I just referred to, they're platforms where you can have R code or Python code and actually some other types of code as well running, and you've got access to visualization software, but also model software that will fit these neural networks or logistic regression models or decision tree models. Microsoft Visual Studio, that is for heavy duty programming, and that's where I spend most of my time, because you can do a lot there, although not as much, and I'll come on to that, as I wanted to. Machine learning studio, I've already mentioned, and I'll show a bit more on that. Azure Storage Explorer, that's very useful for these NoSQL databases, this, where you've got unstructured data of different types. The Azure portal, Azure is Microsoft's cloud framework, so given that I do a lot of cloud computing, that's where I spend a lot of my time. But you can create dashboards in there for management information, and I've created that for my company. They didn't have these before, and now this gives quite a lot of useful information. Google Colabs is that's what I use for this this AI capstone project. That gives you the same as the notebooks, but it also gives you Google's TensorFlow. So very quickly on Excel, it's just very useful, very flexible. You can get a very quick data analysis, and it's nice because you can share it with people who don't know much about data science, or you can share it with senior execs because they can then look at it and look at the charts that you've produced. So it's very good, and I use that often as a first port of call just because it's quick. Now, what you need to do there is you just get your raw data in Excel, which often means copying and pasting from a database, and then you just add an insert power pivot, insert pivot and a table and chart, and then you get something like this. This is actually some data I've done, a website I did for mainly for my son to keep track of pocket money, virtual pocket money. So to encourage him to save, we've got two accounts. We've got a savings account and a current account. The savings account gives him 10% interest per month. Fortunately, he does not save very long. He spends it. Otherwise, I'd have to change the rules. I've told him I'd change the rules if he's going to start saving for a year. The dates are on the bottom there. All I've done is just taken that data, put it into a pivot chart. Along the x-axis is the time, going from 2015 to now. And the vertical axis, that's income and outgo. So what's actually happening, the spikes are his birthday and Christmas time. So money comes in, and it usually goes straight out. But in the meantime, when we encourage him to save, it does go up with quite a bit with the interest. So it goes up with interest there, and then it's spent again. But there's lots of times where I use Excel just for very quick stuff. You can also do very rich visualization if you want to, but they tend to be one-off with Excel. You've got this conditional formatting, you can show trends, and you can communicate, you can send this to senior management who can play around with it, and they like it. You can do statistical tests, comparing populations, comparing means, comparing variances. And you can also do box and whisker charts showing the distribution. So the box and whisker charts, the bottom of the rectangle is the lower quartile, the top is the upper quartile. The whiskers are the outliers, where the last points are, and you can compare distributions very quickly visually like that. So quick and easy, but the difficulty is it's very hard to produce multiple charts. If you want to do lots of charts, you have to produce lots of pivot tables and pivot charts, which gets very boring. Very poor quality control, all the usual problems with Excel, hard to detect errors. And if you want to do interactive dashboards, where if you want to filter on one factor and have all your charts change, it's very hard to do. You have to do lots of VLOOKUP queries in order to relate data from different. So quite often I've downloaded three data from three different tables, and to show it quickly to someone else, I'll do VLOOKUP and relate them. And you can, what I normally have to do is add extra columns in the one that I want to use pivot charts on, so that those extra columns can then be filtered on in the pivot chart. But it works, and it's a first port of call. SQL, structured query language. So this is an example. Apologies if you can't quite read it, but this is for reference. That is actually just saying, give me all these fields from all these columns from a particular table. That's the simplest type of query you can have. But I do much more than that. I use Microsoft SQL Server Management Studio. That's their tool. I think it's free. There's certainly free editions of it that connect with their SQL Server database. So structured query language, you can do more complicated queries. That's an example of an outer join where you give all the records in set A, but also you want to get the fields, the match, in set B. So it's a way of combining data. And you can do that with code, you can do that in Link, language integrated query. You can do it with objects in memory. So you can use the skills that you have with SQL. If you learn SQL, you can use that in code that you write. I don't know about Python and R, where they've got that yet, but I suspect it will be. Certainly with .NET code, if you know SQL, you can write queries that will manipulate your, not just your raw data, but data that you've, objects you've created to extract value, to run very sophisticated queries in a way that you don't have to learn lots of skills. You just know SQL. Now, if you want to run very powerful queries, this is what I do a lot of. Rather than having to use download lots of data into Excel, lots of VLOOKUPs, lots of manipulation, adding columns, and then if I want to do it again when the data's changed, I've got to re-download it, I'll run a script in SQL Server in Management Studio. That, what that does is querying lots of different tables combined together in one script, and that's using something called a derived table, which is a table in memory. It's not a table that exists in the database, but these are very powerful for temporary ways of creating tables that, as intermediate steps. And you know, I love that sort of stuff. You can also use variables if you want to do multiple step queries. You can create a variable in memory rather than a whole table. You have the at sign. So again, if you look this up, well, the slides will be available. I use this stuff a lot. Microsoft Power BI is not free, unfortunately, or I think there's a free trial. This is what I like for sharing dashboards. You can share it with other people, or they have to have a subscription, and it's very easy for senior management to interact with. And it's got a natural language query facility, so it's got AI built in. Microsoft, because it's linked into their cognitive services, you can ask natural questions, and it'll try and interpret you the question you've asked and give you an answer, and you can refine it. You can apply this. The most important thing is you can apply the same filter to all sorts of different charts, and that's what I do, unless I've done a bespoke website that does it, the program, because I'm a programmer, I'll do that. So here's an example of a hypothetical, this is on the course, the data science course, of a store, online store, and retail store as well. And they have sales by different region and different categories. And you've got filters in the left-hand, the drop-down list. And if you select something from a filter, all those charts will change at the same time. So it's very powerful. You can also just click on something. So this is just a PowerPoint, but if I were to click on that, then the data would be restricted to just that category. So it's a very nice way for senior execs or clients to see what the data is telling them. You can have interactive maps as well. So it's very powerful. You put geolocation data in, and there was part of the course that used that. Jupyter Notebooks. These are a free platform where you can have R or Python. And I think you can run other things, but it's mainly R or Python. One nice thing about them is you can have documentation with your code. So you can write ordinary text, format it nicely, and then the next bit, it's like a spreadsheet. But so you have a cell which is just comments and explaining what you're doing. Then you run some R code or Python code, and then you have explain the results. So it's a nice way of sharing a model with someone else. It includes tools to access a wide range of data sources. So you can have Excel files, you can have databases, you can have NoSQL databases. There's lots of stuff you can do. There's visualization tools included as well, so you get those charts that I mentioned, those conditional histograms. So here is an example. On the left, you've got the notebook, and it's in cells by the lines, the horizontal lines. So that is using this epsilon greedy algorithm, which is a reinforcement learning, but this is Python. And it's just going down through the code. You can comment the code, you can run it, and it produces charts within the same notebook. So you get your results. So it's a nice way of getting a user interface output, as well as if you try to write a traditional program in C#, you won't necessarily get the output in the program, in the same document, you get it somewhere else. So it's a quick way of getting machine learning done. And you can use, this is the sort of tools you have in Python and R, which are not yet available in .NET. You have nice visualization tools where, Right. Another 5 minutes. You have you've got two-dimensional charts by necessity, but you're adding other dimensions via color, use of color, and use of symbols and size as well. So this was a model to predict the price of cars depending on characteristics, whether they were petrol or diesel, the length, the curb length, the weight, number of cylinders. So there's multi-factors, and you can express that, those multi-factors, on a two-dimensional chart thanks to this faceting, and you can do that quite nicely with Python. Microsoft Visual Studio, that's the professional coding platform. It's for more bespoke analysis. You can use R or Python within it, but I tend to use C#. And it's got excellent integration with Microsoft's cloud computing platform. So that's an example that I've just been doing for fun. It's a program to learn to play chess and to try and improve itself. I did try and have a go at seeing whether a big data solution would work for it, but I think I've worked out there's 10 to the 150 different positions, possible positions. Because the idea is, as something suggested my long-standing colleague David Wilkie, that if you just have a stupid program that just plays randomly, it knows how many moves it can make. So when you start the game, there are 20 moves possible. It just chooses those with a random probability of 5% each. It keeps playing randomly, and it's playing against itself, so it's the same rules apply to black as to white. If it wins, it then updates the probabilities by saying, well, the last move won, I'll give that a probability of 1, and it goes back and increases the probabilities of the others slightly less. And then similarly, if it loses, it reduces the probabilities a lot for the last move, and eventually it will learn. Now, if you can do that with a smaller problem like tic-tac-toe or noughts and crosses. But with chess, the problem is that there's so much randomness, it's like trying to hunt for a planet in space with so much vast space. So a simple example, if you've got queen and king versus king, well, the queen's very powerful, but the queen's got lots of possible moves. And the only way, a human knows, the only way you will mate a king is by pushing the king to the edge of the board, moving your own king up to it, and then having the queen protected by you. Now, a random program will not do that. So the sort of blind learning will not work. So you have to build in some intelligence. And I've tried to start doing that. And I was hoping to demonstrate this. But anyway, it's PowerPoint. And it's taking too much time. So Azure Machine Learning Studio, that is a nice graphical tool for running models. You can just drag data in. You've got different modules you can have. So you have modules for dragging data in from different sources. You've got modules to clean the data, to split it up into a training set and a test set. So, you know, typically you might just put 70% of the data or 60% of the data will be used to train your model, and then you'll test it to make sure it's not overfitting on the remaining 30%, 40%. And it will randomly split the data for you. You can then drag in different modules for the different types of models, whether it's logistic regression, decision tree forest. You can also have custom code in R or Python. So it's a very nice piece of kit. So there was a credit scoring example in this. It was, again, classification, simple classification between 0 and 1, good risk or bad risk. And, again, that's a logistic model that you can write a custom script. It's a very nice user interface, and there's a free version, but again, if you want to use more powerful, it can get paid. And a nice thing about it is that you can move a trained model to production. So you built your nice model. How do you actually socialize that? How do you get other people to use that? Well, you can just simply use Machine Learning Studio. It will create a web service for you. So all you have to do then, you can open Excel, you can put the data that you want to put through the model, and you have an add-in into Excel and say, here's my data in these cells. Press a button, it sends the data to the cloud where Machine Learning Studio is. It then runs your model, and it returns the results. So that's a very nice way of sharing your model with other people, with clients or other members of parts of the business. It gives you a good analysis of the data. It automatically gives you a statistical analysis of the of each column. So you've got a histogram there, but you can also have a box and whisker chart. It tells you about missing values. So it's a nice way to get a quick view of the data. And it gives you these an evaluate model tool that will check the model and see how good a fit it is, how well it fits your test data. You know it fits your training data well, but how does it fit your test data? Now, some ethical issues. Now, the institute and faculty I've mentioned on the council of, we did a joint task force with the Royal Statistical Society looking into possible ethical guidance for our members and their members. And we looked at lots of different existing ethical frameworks around the world and tried to encapsulate them and put them into a small set of principles. And we came up with five principles. There were three actuaries on the group. Originally, there were three actuaries and three members of the RSS, but one of the RSS members had to drop out. So there were two. And we also had Alicia Watson, who's in the IFOA's legal services team, because obviously this ethics thing comes to do with professional standards. And we came up with five principles. So the first one, and these were published in, they're guidance for ethical use of data science, joint with us and the RSS. First principle is to try and add value, use data science, artificial intelligence to add value for society. The second one is avoid harm. That's to do with trying to avoid discrimination, trying to make sure that it's not unfair, it's not... It's not removing individuals' autonomy, is another way of it. Apply and maintain professional competence, that's professional standards, saying you've got to clean the data, you've got to make sure that you review your models, that your model might have worked, but now the data's changed or the situation's changed. Make sure you've considered things properly from a professional point of view. Fourth one is seek to preserve or increase trustworthiness. Now, the counterexample to that is Cambridge Analytica, which misused data. So as a result, people don't trust their data being in Facebook as much as they did before. So an ethical organization or an ethical data scientist, artificial intelligence, big data person will be trying to increase trust all the time, because trust is a valuable social asset. The more we trust the data and the more we know it's going to be used properly, then the more benefit we can get from AI. The fifth one is try and keep control of the process. Make sure we've got proper governance, and actually, from my point of view, make sure that AI doesn't take over, because you know we could give it a problem like how do we maximise the production of paperclips? An AI model might say, well, actually, humans get in the way of that. We don't need them. My goal is to maximise production of paperclips. You have to be very careful about how. What the goals are, because they will be able to think in ways that we can't understand. They can communicate in ways that we can't understand. So there is this principle of AI super intelligence that will be reached at some point. Now, how do we maintain control of that? That's a big issue. So useful resources. Again, this is more for reference. The IFOA is introducing a certificate in data science sometime soon this year. I understand it's about 100 hours work. Well, that's slightly less than the 650 hours I spent on the three. But this is just data science. It's not big data or AI. It's probably a mixture of all three. I don't quite know what all the details of it yet are. The online course providers, I use edX, but there's also Udemy. Microsoft Azure, you can get a year's free use of their cloud computing. Microsoft Learn, that is the replacement to this professional program. I have done some courses on that. It's quite different. You don't get a certificate, which is slightly disappointing. You do. There are exams at the end of it, but you don't get the immediate reward, because I used to like doing a course and in 3 or 4 weeks I've got the certificate. And pat myself on the back, because as an actuarial student, you don't get that so quickly. But the Microsoft Learn's got lots of resources there. Unfortunately, for some of the courses, you actually have to sit an exam in person rather than doing it at your computer. So it's a bit more... I haven't quite done that yet. I'm too lazy to take a day off work and actually go and sit in an exam centre. The Guide for Ethical Data Science, there's the URL for that. The IFOA's got its Data Science Hub, which has... quite a lot of stuff there. Google Colabs, that's what I use for this speech processing problem. That has, it's like the Azure notebooks, you can use Python and R, but it's using the Google technology, which is very, very powerful. The Keras is very, very useful, TensorFlow. Kaggle, data science competitions, but it's also has notebooks, so you've got three versions of that. You can get code on there. You can do a lot of testing yourself. It's got some nice training courses as well. I had hoped to spend quite a bit of time on Kaggle before I gave this talk, when I agreed to do it 3 or 4 months ago, but unfortunately, I've had no time because of other stuff taking over my new job. But that is something that I want to explore, because there's some interesting training courses on there. I did the first one and found it quite useful. So that's probably worth looking at. And of course, it's very, you can, if you get good at this, you can earn money. But I know from doing these courses, the capstone courses, that there are other people who got much, much better marks. And I suspect, I was in the middle doing these predictive models, and where I'm getting 83% rather than my usual 96 or 100% I was doing on the other courses. And there were some people who were getting 95, 96%, even on these very, very difficult marks. And I suspect that they are people who have been doing it for quite a while. Like, you know, why would they want to do a course? Perhaps they just want a certificate. But there are some people out there who are very, very experienced at this and very good at this. Now, whether that matters so much, if you're wanting to do this, I'd just get into it, get stuck in. You will improve, you will learn a lot, and you'll be able to add value for your employers and customers. I'm convinced of that. So, challenges. How do we understand these deep learning networks? How do we trade off between, like this chess example I've said, you throw in more intelligence, that's one way of doing it. Also, you can just say, let's just use more computing power. We've got more data, let's just do it that way. How do you work out the balance? Lots of ethical challenges, that's the next question, next slide. And then, nowadays, you've got to have models that will run in the cloud, which can obviously be very, very powerful. You've got Microsoft having their cognitive learning kits, which will recognize speech, recognize images, so that you'll send your data there, and the whole model's there available, using all their data, and it can just give you the answer. But if you're running your car, it's not going to be connected to the internet all the time, so it has to run offline, and your mobile phone has to run offline. So you want a model also that runs locally, which is capable of running with much less data and much less processing power. So how do you do the trade-off between that? Okay. So, in the news a couple of days ago, breast cancer. Models come up that is actually as good as two top consultants in detecting breast cancer. I don't know whether this particular model is explainable. I've just seen the headline and talked about it with a couple of people. But if it's not explainable, should we be barred from using it? Should the government or the regulators bar us from using it? Given that, say, these two top consultants are not going to be available for everybody, you've got remote parts of the world where they have to travel a long distance to see a doctor. If that model can be put there and detect cancer, not just breast cancer, but you could apply it to any serious disease, and the detection rate, the earlier it is, increases the chance of survival massively, should the GDPR regulation that says that stuff has got to be explainable, should that stop it being used? If Nazi Germany had suddenly, everyone else had moved on, but Nazi Germany was transported forward to our time, and we knew that they were developing autonomous lethal weapons, which Google have said they won't work on, and ethically, most ethical frameworks say we shouldn't work on, but we knew that Nazi Germany was around now and was working on them. Should we work on those, or should we say, no, that's unethical? Should NHS Trust share data? At the moment, they don't do much. They might try and do it as anonymously as possible. There are still problems with that. But if they share data, it would enable AI models to detect rare diseases or problems with drugs, side effects with drugs, earlier than without it. Again, there's the collision between privacy and the public good. Should autonomous vehicles be programmed? If the vehicle detects it's going to crash, it can't avoid crashing and it can't avoid killing people, should it be programmed to maximize useful quality of life? So if it's a baby versus a 99-year-old, it would be programmed, if it can't avoid killing someone, to kill the 99-year-old. But what if it's a baby and it's 70-year-old Stephen Hawking, or before he died. You know, it's very, very difficult to do those sort of things. Credit card company, and this is actually in a Kaggle competition. They've got a model to predict fraud, but they want to improve it. So they put it on a Kaggle competition because they want to see what people will come up with. They have hundreds of factors. Should they tell the people taking part in the competition what these factors are so that they can use their intelligence to think about what factors might be? Or should they just keep them anonymous? Because the danger is fraudsters will also be looking at this and saying, if these factors are important, we'll game those. You know, number of addresses, number of email addresses. If that's a symptom of a fraudster having lots and lots of email addresses, then if they get wise to that, then it'd be harder to detect. All our mobile phones have lots of data, geolocation data. If somebody gets stopped by the police for, say, being breathalyzed, should the police be entitled to just look at your phone and they take you to the police station because they think you need to be breathalyzed? Should they be allowed to then put your data into a device that says, hang on, you were at such and such a place an hour ago, you're now here, you were driving your car, you must have done an average of 85 miles an hour. You know, my contact details at the end there. Thank you very much for your attention. I'm happy to take your challenging questions. And I hope you have something to take away with you and get stuck into this wonderful world of exciting world of AI and data and the stuff we can do for our clients and our just humanity is amazing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Patrick, for your talk. I trust that you all learned more about big data, data science, and AI, and you found a range of useful tools that you could use to practice over the coming months. So now I'll open the floor to questions. So Kate here on the left and John will bring a microphone, so just raise your hand if you have any questions. Here on the left, Kate, please. Just your name and whether you're a fellow or student, please.
Hi, I'm Umaru. I'm a actuarial student. So I guess my question is more on the human element with data science and big data and going into AI, because you talked about like AI trying to essentially remove the human element. Do you think there's a point where we'll get to where you don't longer need that human element, and should we get to that point? Because I guess, would that take away the creativity that humans bring?
That is a very apposite question. I mean, I personally am convinced that AI will be able to take over within 20 years, 30 years at most. So the question for any company, any employer, is why employ a human who needs to sleep, who has to take holiday, is sick from time to time, gets tired, when a program or a robot or a combination of two could do both? So I think AI will take over, and we have to make the transition as a civilized society, and we have to decide how we're going to give people their dignity. I think some kind of universal income would do that, because, and it wouldn't need to be very high, because if you think about the increase in productivity from robots, the price of computers is a computer now is about 100 times more valuable than it was 20 years ago, because the price has come down, the power's gone up. That's a 100-fold increase in productivity. That's just from technology without the intelligence behind it. I think, and it's universal income of the level of sort of £1,000 a year per person would enable the equivalent of £100,000 for us. So we could have that. Companies could be taxed on their profits, taxed robot. They wouldn't, no point having income tax on robots, but you tax the company on profits, and that would then pay for us to all have a life of leisure. We would be able to study, we'd be able to do music, drama, painting, sport, lots of wonderful things, but we need to make that transition from the economy we have now. It's going to be very hard to do that in 15, 20 years, but I think we need to think about that. Thank you for the question.
Here on the left.
I'm Matt Thomas, fellow. So you talked about the fact that you think in 20 years' time, machines are going to take over. My understanding is that things are slowing down in terms of Moore's Law, like the chips aren't getting as fast as they were maybe 10, 20 years ago. So do you see that acceleration coming from software? And I suppose from a insurance industry point of view, sorry, this is two questions really, we tend to be behind the curve. We're quite a slow industry to get on board these new exciting things. So where do you think we should be looking to get started on this stuff?
Okay. First question, I think it's going to carry on doing it because there's quantum computing as well. It's not there yet, but it's starting to... They found an application for the existing quantum machines just recently. When that happens, the quantum machines will be millions, hundreds of millions times more powerful than the existing ones. So that will make Moore's Law look like child's play. I think you're right that the software in itself will be able to do things so much faster anyway. So the robots producing goods will do so with very tiny rates of error, be able to produce things of much higher quality, much more quantity. So that in itself will produce the economic growth. In terms of the insurance industry, I think it is difficult because it's the same with large banks. I think often the software that's there is very old. It's using old versions of Windows. And I for the life of me, can't understand why people don't take the... It is a risk to upgrade, but you know, the longer it's left, the worse it gets. Windows 7, I think, is nearing the end of its life. So I think the insurance industry has a challenge, but you've got wearables, you've got new devices coming on, so if you can start using the newer software, you can still add a lot of value to your clients, produce more tailored insurance, so short-term insurance that only relates as needed, like they might do in the third world. If someone's taking a flight, they just get insurance just for that one flight. There's a whole load of stuff that I think can be done. But it is a challenge to the legacy systems, how to move that.
Okay, there's three questions here, so we're going to start with the gentleman here in front. Yeah.
Patrick, that was really a superb talk. A slightly off-the-wall kind of thing. We've had... an awful lot of discussions, presentations in this room about climate change and implications. If you put issues around climate change and perhaps limitations to growth that might come out of thinking about the world's resources together with what you've just been talking about, what comes in your mind?
I have to say that I'm very sceptical about climate change. I think there's been a lot of politicalization of it. And if you look at what's actually happened, the 2010s have been the best decade for humanity ever in terms of reduction of poverty on a worldwide basis. There are lots of good things happening from economic growth. Now, there are very bad things happening. I mean, Australia, the fires are terrible, but there's a lot of arson happening there. But what the history shows is that if we embrace economic growth, we can often cope with it. So you take Holland. They've had places that are 7 meters underwater. Now, the sea levels are rising, I think, at 50 centimeters a year. 50 centimeters a century at the moment. If we can't cope with that sort of level, even in the poorest parts of the world, with economic growth, we should be able to afford to do that. So I'm very much a skeptic on that. But I also think that new solutions will come with the power that AI comes. I mean, world poverty could be solved in theory. Asimov was saying this 60, 70 years ago. We've got enough food to feed the whole planet. It's a distribution, an economic problem, and a logistic one. Now, supercomputers could probably do that. So there's a lot of good stuff. I'm an optimist. I'm not pessimistic. I mean, Trump and Iran aside at the moment, I'm not pessimistic at all about the... I think there's never been a better time to be a mathematician, a programmer, a data scientist. I'm not quite sure because I think there will be downward pressure on earnings because of the competition. But nevertheless, it should still be we earn slightly less, but we get more interesting work, and we're actually adding even greater value. So I'm optimistic. I hope not misplaced.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. That really was a mind-blowing talk. I just want to tap into one point you mentioned, which was the reference to chess and using artificial intelligence to play chess. And this kind of links to the transparency idea. Now, I'm assuming from what you said that you as a human decides how your program is going to learn. So you got about the basic option where you've got a finite number of moves and each one is randomly selected and the machine remembers which won, which lost, and there's a clear definition of success and failure. But then you said that you want to make it more efficient, so you then decide how it wants it to learn. So one of the things of transparency is that will we be able to communicate how the human has programmed or instructed the computer to actually learn? And secondly, in the, I think it was the in the cancer example, and you, so you say, well, artificial intelligence can actually do it better. Now, unlike chess, where you know exactly what success is because you've achieved checkmate, or you're the opposite. In the cancer example, how are you defining success? Who is actually doing that? And again, their whole transparency around that. So, if you could comment on that.
Okay, thank you. Transparency is very important, and documentation is needed for that. I think in the chess particular problem, I'm deciding that it's actually not good to. It's fun to try and program it to be clever, but actually you end up having to do more and more work because it's not going to recognise symmetry. So I can teach it that. It wants to, it can win in a particular position, but then if you rotate the position 90 degrees, a human would recognize that straight away. But without programming the software to do that explicitly, in this explicit way I'm doing it, it wouldn't work. Whereas these convolutional neural networks are designed to be clever enough to recognize symmetry automatically after a time. I mean, not the basic CNNs, but the more complicated ones. So, it gets to a point you don't interfere because you don't want to stop it doing what it's so good because it's doing it in ways that we don't know. That's my understanding of these deep neural networks. The Alpha Go Zero that taught itself to play chess and Go and beat the not just Go the human Go champion but Alpha Go that had beaten the world champion before, and it learnt entirely playing against itself. It didn't have any sort of rules. It just did it. It got some algorithm that just they just apply this algorithm. I don't think it's completely published, but that is there's very little interference. But if there was interference, then it should be documented for transparency, same as all code changes. Now, the breast cancer. I think obviously you can't tell if you've got a program that says, "I'm very sorry, but this person's got this disease now." And the two human consultants didn't detect it. You're right, you won't know that until later, perhaps a few months later and it's got more obvious. And then the two humans agree. I think you can only tell after the event, but once you've got time, then they've got a better track record. The machines have got a better track record than the humans. Then you have to make the ethical decision. At what point do we say, right, our regulation is costing us lives? We don't understand how it's doing it, but it seems to work. My personal view is that when you've got enough evidence, an evidence-based approach, you have to say, I'm sorry, we don't understand how it works, but we will save lives, we'll do it, until such point as the evidence points the other way and it's actually being too invasive and giving people too many false positives. So, yes, a good question. You can't tell straight away. I mean, I've only seen the headline on this, but I know that... The quality rates are getting very good. And lawyers as well, programs can predict the outcomes of court cases pretty well now and find defects in contracts better than experts. This is why I think jobs will go. If a program can detect with a lot of accuracy, a decision of judge in a court case, eventually you don't need the judge. If you don't need the lawyers if it can find defects in contracts. You don't need an actuary if it can do choose the assumptions for the valuation and choose a model. I mean, not even choose. So what is it that we've got that will stop the programs from beating us? It's very hard to think, other than art and music. But even then, some programs are composing music, which is pretty good. So it's just for our leisure, for our own dignity, and we have to remain masters of the computers, because otherwise they don't need us. Why should their economic growth go on us? Why should we have? But that's why that fifth principle is very important. But I had arguments, or not arguments, too wrong a word, but another member of our focus group was saying, the whole history says you don't stand in the way of progress, so don't try and stop a machine getting more powerful. But people like Stephen Hawking was warning about this. He said AI is either going to be the best thing that's ever happened to the human race or the very worst thing, and we just don't know which yet. Sorry, I hope that goes some way.
We're going to go here on the right.
Hi, my name's Edmund, and I'm not even a student member yet, but hoping to be one if I pass in April. I'd find it really interesting what you just said there, echoed quite a lot what Dominic Cummings was saying about Vote Leave, and he was saying that in his How Vote Leave Won, he was saying all jobs will be replaced by data scientists. Especially in communications companies. And he said that's how physicists won the Leave campaign rather than MSC Saatchi equivalents. And I was wondering, with that in mind, are developers and coders in building to this utopian state or whatever in 30 years or maybe longer, let's say 100, are they turkeys voting for Christmas as they develop a machine that's going to take away their own job?
I think we have to keep control of it. I think there's no stopping it. You can't stop progress in a competitive world. I mean, the question about autonomous weapons, lethal autonomous weapons, the US might decide not to do it, UK might decide not to do it, but some country or organization doesn't even have to be a nation, it could just be an organization could decide to do it. They might have enough computing power to have drones that are so powerful that And fighter planes, if a human pilot cannot withstand more than, I don't know, 7G or 9, even with an anti-gravity suit. So if a drone can do 15G and it'll outmaneuver human pilots, so eventually you end up just having pilots in the sky being not needed, not humans. We can't stop progress. I want to be part of the group that's doing this, A, because I think it's good for human progress despite that, and we can't stop it, but I want to be part of it so that I can help argue the case for controlling it. But also I think it's going to be, there's lots of potential for good, and we can't stop it. It's scientific progress. Big challenge though.
I think we have time for one more question, so yeah, here. Thank you.
Hi there. My name's Arnab. I'm a student. Thank you for the talk. I think you touched upon this earlier. What do you think the biggest challenges are for actuaries compared to non-actuaries who are trying to get into this field? What can actuaries bring to the table that non-actuaries can't?
It's a very good question. I mean, I got my current job not because I'm an actuary, but because of my software knowledge. And because I could demonstrate websites, cloud computing, data. And actually, it could have been a hindrance because people think, well, you know, actuaries want very high salaries. I don't actually earn a proper actuarial salary, but I'm so interested in this, I'd rather do this. I think, so actuaries will struggle on grounds of price. But I think as more and more of us get into it, employers will recognize the value that we have in business terms. So I've been able to negotiate a saving with Microsoft for my company because they were overcharging us. And that's because I realised what the problem was. I could argue it properly. Now, I'm not saying no one else in the country could do that, but I was able to do it. And that's because I think of the problem-solving skills I have developed as the excellent training I got at what's now Willis Towers Watson, and working with excellent clients like Equitas. And you get to develop. You're working with quality people, and you get good experience. So I hope that as more of us get into this sphere, and we're better positioned than data scientists in many ways because we already have the ear of senior managers. They will struggle a bit more. We're better communicators on the whole. I mean, that was one of the problems with the discussion forums on the course. There are a lot of terrible communication and very low-level stuff. So, I mean, there are lots of people taking the course who shouldn't have been doing it, really. They should have been doing more basic maths or computing stuff. But there were also people who were getting very, very high marks on these challenges. And my hat's off to them. I don't know how they do it. So Kaggle competitions, I expect it would take me a year or so to be able to even remotely catch up with those people. And I haven't got that time to spare at the moment, but I want to do some of it part-time because I'm sure I will learn. And there's some excellent training there. And the other thing is, there's such a variety of competitions. It'll give you ideas as to what can you use this data science for, what sort of models can you build. You'll get ideas. And being actuaries, you'll probably come up with new ideas for new models that other people won't because you've got this business knowledge and you know which is more financially important. So you'll be able to come up with models that have more impact, I hope, on their business than the typical data scientists will. So it is a challenge, though, because there are millions of data scientists coming on stream, apparently, and they're being pushed by Microsoft and Google and others because they use these cloud platforms. Microsoft gets most of its money from Azure now. It doesn't get so much from Windows and Office. Well, Office 365 is cloud-based, but that's where the future is. And these platforms, these cognitive services are available, but you pay for them. So you can have language understanding intelligent services, which someone speaks or someone types. I've got a website where the user doesn't have to click on menus. They just type what they want to do, and it takes them there. And that's using LUIS, Language Understanding Intelligence Services, from Microsoft, which I pay for. So Microsoft make money this way, and they can do it. You can get image recognition, sound recognition, voice recognition. What the implications are for security, I don't know. Facial recognition, well, the computer's going to be able to generate that and fool your phone as to who you are. So it's not very secure. And voice recognition, all this stuff is being made available.
Thank you, Patrick, and thank you, everyone, for your contribution tonight. I think it was a range of questions. So I'm going to award... I feel like I have a lot of power right now, so I'm going to award for the fellow to... I'm really sorry, I didn't get your name. It was the last question for a student and for a fellow... Just a reminder, there's a networking event in the hall, so please, if you can, join us there. And once again, a big thank you to Patrick for his talk tonight. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Please connect with me on LinkedIn if you're passionate about this, and I want to hear what you get up to. Thank you.